This is Dr. Sahar Kamir. Welcome to my program, The Bridge. A monthly show bridging different cultures, communities, and faith traditions. Watch The Bridge on America's Voice of the Arab Network on all social media platforms.
Welcome, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamis. Welcome to another episode of the program, The Bridge, on U.S. Arab Radio. Today, we are discussing a very timely and important topic. In fact, the most timely and most important topic that everybody is talking about, the American Students' Spring. In America, its significance and its implications. And with me this morning are two university professors who are very much involved and active in these protests and very much aware of their importance, significance, and implications. They are Dr. Elizabeth Anker, Professor of American Studies at George Washington University, and Professor William Humans, Associate Professor of Media Studies and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining me today. I really appreciate it so much.
Thank you for having us.
Wonderful. And allow me to call you both Libby and Will in the interview. But of course, your official titles, like we mentioned in the introduction, Dr. Elizabeth Anker and Dr. William Humans. So Libby, I'll start with you. And I want you to give our listeners and viewers, please, a brief idea about your latest book. Congratulations on that. Ugly Freedoms, published in 2022. Give us a brief synopsis about this book and also, most importantly, its relevance to the current events and affairs.
Ugly Freedoms looks at the ways in which we often see people using the language of freedom in order to justify violence and oppression against other people. And so I think we can certainly see this in the way in which a lot of politicians in the United States are claiming that Israel has the freedom to do whatever it wants in Gaza, that this freedom is righteous, that it is retaliatory, and also the way in which there's a kind of freedom against the protesters, that the protesters are wrong, and the way in which we keep freedom is by arresting them or punishing them in some way. And so I think we can see a lot of forms of ugly freedoms operating in the language that people are using to describe the war on Gaza and the student responses.
Fantastic. Definitely a very clear and succinct connection between the book and the current events. And just to put a plug for the book here, if people want to purchase the book, where can they do so?
Thanks. It's available on any platform, Amazon, Biblio, Bookshop, or in your local bookstore.
Awesome. Congratulations again on this achievement.
Thank you.
Will, I want to come to you with a question. How did it all start? What ignited the flames of this quote-unquote student spring, as we are seeing it unfold right now? And what is the historical significance? There is definitely a historical context, historical significance for these protests. So please let us know a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the immediate cause for the encampment movement has to be, you know, Israel's unfolding genocide in Gaza, which began in October 2023. But Palestinian solidarity activism did not just start on campuses. In fact, it goes back many decades. But many of the encampments are calling for divestment. They're calling for universities to end their investments in companies and in other entities that do business with Israel, and specifically profit off weapons or the occupation or aspects of force. And the divestment movement goes back more than 20 years, starting in the West Coast, actually, at University of California, Berkeley.
Yes, but I also wanted to refer to the historical context in terms of similar students' protests that have erupted and unfolded in the past. Like, you know, in the 60s and 70s, there have been some precedents for that on university campuses in the United States. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. Yeah, there were, from the 1960s, there were very vigorous protest movements on campuses around the anti-war movement and Vietnam, before that free speech on campuses and civil rights movements as well. Fast forwarding to the 1980s, there was a huge movement calling for divestment from South African apartheid. And this was all over U.S. campuses, and many universities divested actually from South Africa as part of an international solidarity movement. And that's what led in the early 2000s to Palestinian solidarity movements on campuses, largely through the organizations known as Students for Justice in Palestine. They kind of emulated that and set up some small refugee camps or checkpoints on campuses or took over buildings. But nothing that they did in the early 2000s and since really compares with what we've seen since October. I mean, more specifically in the last month, where over 50 campuses with over 3,000 students getting arrested at these encampments. I mean, this has been a really vigorous moment that I have never seen anything like that in terms of Palestine solidarity activism. But it follows a long line of campus activism in general. And it's one of the few places in American society where these kinds of social justice campaigns have a long tradition and really tend to thrive generation after generation. So this frustrates policymakers and the aristocrats and everyone else who's used to being able to control debate and discussion on campus or in society in general, because what happens on campus is beyond their control.
Right. And we can also mention the civil rights movement, right? Like, you know, the war against Vietnam, you know, the protests against, of course, the war in Vietnam, and also at the same time, the civil rights movement. These have been also very important, iconic moments in the history of students' protests in the United States. But it's fair to say that we have not witnessed this scale of students' protests since these iconic moments back in the 60s and 70s, when we're talking about the protests against the war on Vietnam and against, of course, as you said, apartheid South Africa and also the civil rights movement. So that's why it's a very historically important and significant moment, as you mentioned. Thank you so much for that.
I know Libby probably has some thoughts on that.
I think the historic nature of this is important. We have seen a lot of recent movements among students calling for divestment from fossil fuels, for instance, and that's been a large segment of campus life. And we do know that universities have responded to that and have begun to divest from investments in fossil fuels, often being pushed by students. So I also think a lot of students on campuses were galvanized by that and saw the divestments, calling for divestments from weapons manufacturing, from companies that were supporting the war in Israel. You know, they saw that this has been successful, and I think that's part of what we're seeing now, but even at a much more significant scale. And part of what's so significant is the way in which these protests have been so deeply repressed and violently repressed, but, you know, from the police in other ways, in the way in which we certainly did not see for any climate movement.
Right, right. And my last, you know, figure or piece of information has been that it actually reached more than 120 different campuses in the United States. So it started small with a few handful of universities, started to spread to almost 20 and then 33. And then it became more than 120 universities in the United States, not to mention also the echoes internationally and globally, where it started to reach Canada, Britain, France, and even Australia. So it started to have also some kind of ripple effect on the international and global sphere.
Yeah. Can I add something that a lot of media have been asking questions about these movements, about these encampments, saying, you know, oh, is there an outside agitator? Is there a central force that is or organization that is actually putting these things together? And one thing I wanted to point out was, if that was the case, you'd expect all the encampments to go up around the same time, but that didn't happen at all. It started with one, then two, and quickly it spread through something that looks more like contagion, where there was a lot of emulation. And in these campments, the protesters were sort of learning from each other. And so the idea that this was something that was centrally planned by any organization is just ridiculous.
I want to also ask, Will and Libby, both of you, because both of you are at George Washington University, and obviously there has been a very big momentum there in terms of students' protests. I'll start with you, Libby, like in terms of your role, the role that you played actually in the midst of these protests, if you're willing to talk about that. What was this role and what was the significance and importance of this role?
You know, at George Washington University, and I think like most places, the protests were organized and galvanized by the students amongst themselves. And so the roles of faculty, you know, were different and variegated. But for me personally, I felt like I had somewhat of a dual role. On the one hand, I was down there every day making sure the students sort of had what they needed and were also being protected. We did have outside, you know, counter protests. We were worried often that the police were going to come, even though the police for many times refused to even, you know, enter the camps because they were so peaceful. But, you know, I think me and a lot of other faculty understood ourselves to be somewhat of a buffer to allow the students to continue the protest in the way that they saw fit. And that was our role. And my second role was to serve almost as an interpreter to the outside world, because so much of the media coverage of what the students were doing was incorrect. Mm-hmm. The students were constantly being called, right? Either whether it's outside agitators, we're being called violent, we're being called anti-Semitic. And so I understood my role as trying to do some of that counter-programming to explain to the world that what the students were doing was actually really peaceful. They were deeply, you know, they had a lot of political courage and moral conviction in what they were doing. They were united around calling for a ceasefire, calling for stopping the war, united for Palestinian liberation and freedom. And to get that message across and not the, you know, that they were violent or that they wanted to harm people, you know, or that, you know, even that they were anti-Semitic, you know, some of my Jewish students estimated that between 25 to 30% of the students at the GW encampment were Jewish. That included a lot of the organizers in the encampment. And one of my students who was down there, who was also an Israeli citizen, but who was also in the encampment, estimated that among the white presenting students, about half of them were Jewish students. And so constantly trying to show the work of what was happening in the encampment, the way the students were trying to create a multi-religious support for Palestine and for Palestinian freedom, you know, was a role that I think faculty could take on when the media were misdiagnosing what was actually happening and what the students were trying to advocate for.
I love that. So a buffer and an interpreter. These are two very, very important roles. Thanks for that. And I'll come to you, Will, with the same question. Also in terms of your role in the midst of these protests, and how do you interpret this role, and how do you believe in its importance and significance?
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I think that we had a very loose coalition so that different faculty could kind of decide what their affiliation with the camp would be. So I definitely started out as more of an observer. And then I also started doing media interviews similarly to what Libby was talking about and trying to translate for the world what was happening. And one reason why that was important was I found that a lot of times the students didn't trust talking to reporters because they felt so grossly misrepresented. So oftentimes I would be speaking to the reporters that they wouldn't want to speak with. And I certainly understand where their position was coming from because of so many bad experiences that they had, and they just felt overwhelmed by the mischaracterizations. So, but then I kind of moved away from also being an observer or a monitor, as I was calling myself, to becoming more vocal within the camp. So I spoke at some of the rallies, and I would, you know, try to offer advice to the students who were doing negotiations. Of course, the students, you know, as Libby pointed out, this was very self-initiated. They planned it, they carried it all out themselves. They didn't ask any faculty I know of any for any advice. So a lot of it was, you know, them acting on their own. And that's another reason why I think that the argument that there's these outside agitators or other external groups that were able to organize them is ridiculous to me. These students knew what they were doing. And they of course would learn from other protests, but they were really driving it on their own. And so I was just there to support, but I became very vocally supportive, not just of their rights to protest, which is an important thing to defend, but also in furtherance of what they were demanding, disclosure of university investments that would be morally problematic, and divestment from them as well. And they were also calling for the university to lift the suspensions of them. And the university had these like prior charges against a lot of the student groups based on very, you know, thin violations, you know, almost discretionary kind of notions of whatever the rules are for speech on campus. There were a lot of restrictions. You needed permission to sort of do a lot of things, mm-hmm. Which protests are just part of the robust sphere of public speech on campuses, but the university was still going after them, I think, in an effort to silence them.
Right. So an observer, but also a supporter and a participant. That is really very admirable. Thank you so much.
I couldn't observe, you know, at some point I could no longer be an observer credibly. So I moved away from that because you really have to be careful about what role you're going to play. If you're going to be neutral, you can't be too active of a participant.
Right. So you had like a role switch. You started as an observer and a person who was monitoring, and then you became more actively involved and really also an outspoken person who was speaking to the media and trying to clarify some of the issues that students maybe will find difficult to clarify on their own, or in some cases, they may feel vulnerable, you know, being the face of the movement or the face of the protests on public media. We'll come back to this very important and interesting discussion right after this commercial break. Stay tuned, please.
Get ready for an amazing experience at Ishtar Restaurant on 15 Mile Road in Sterling Heights. Enjoy excellent hospitality from owners Ali Abagdadi and Fatty Bonham, serving the best in Mediterranean food. Try Chef Ali Abagdadi's famous shawarma, the best Iraqi grills and food, and the best Arabic and international dishes. Dine in our authentic atmosphere or take out. Call 586-698-2585 or check us out on Facebook. Ishtar Restaurant practices all CDC guidelines and is open every day 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Have an amazing experience today at Ishtar Restaurant, 3625 15 Mile Road, Sterling Heights.
Hey, Michigan drivers, are you sending or answering group chats behind the wheel, checking emails at the light, calling family or friends on the commute? Michigan's hands-free law makes it illegal to manually use electronic devices while behind the wheel of a vehicle. Breaking the law could mean fines or even community service. Go hands-free. Just drive. It's the law. Learn more at michigan.gov/distracted driving. A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.
Life for Relief and Development has now been rated as one of the best charities for humanitarian aid. Life's humanitarian projects span the globe, and Life is celebrating its 30th anniversary of providing essential life-saving aid to people and communities in 36 countries, regardless of race, color, religion, or cultural background. Where there is life, there is hope. And when disaster occurs here or around the world, including being one of the first responders to the Turkey-Syria earthquake crisis, Life for Relief and Development rushes in to provide food, medical aid, and shelter to those in need. We are looking to help the earthquake victims, and we take 0% overhead on emergency donations. So please help improve these efforts. Learn more about our involvement to help the helpless and bring hope where it's needed most, and make your tax-deductible donation to Life for Relief and Development now at lifeusa.org or call 248-424-7493. That's 248-424-7493.
Welcome back again to the show, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamis, and we're talking today about the American Student Spring, the goals, the objectives, the significance, and the implications. And with me this morning discussing this important and timely topic are Dr. Elizabeth Anker, Professor of American Studies at George Washington University, and Dr. William Humans, Associate Professor of Media Studies and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Libby, before going to the commercial break, Will was talking about some of the goals and objectives of these particular protests. What are the demands of the students? And I want you to elaborate a little bit more on this particular point, these particular demands and these particular objectives and goals. How many of them you think have been successfully achieved so far, and how many remain to be achieved?
It's a complicated question. And one thing I'll note is, you know, different campuses, the students made different demands at their universities, and different universities responded to their demands in different ways. So some of them met with the students and met some of their demands. Some of them met with the students and maybe met one demand. And some universities just sent police to crack down on their students. Instead of actually de-escalating, they escalated and criminalized. You know, GW did a combination of some of those things. They tried to bring in the police, but the police would not come in and would not break up the encampment because it was too peaceful. Eventually they did, right before the Republicans, you know, were threatening to bring the mayor of Washington, D.C. in before the Republican Congress people in order to kind of punish her publicly for not having the police come in. So GW's, you know, we had a lot more national interference, which I also think made it a little bit harder for some of the students to get their demands. So they are still in the process of negotiation. We do know that the university did not suspend so far a lot of the students who were participating, who they had given a temporary suspension to. But on all of the other negotiations, the students are still in dialogue with them. And there might end up being some more of a hiatus during the summer than I think the students would have liked. But the students were calling for divestment. They were calling for disclosure, where the university would publicly list all of the companies, you know, that they had invested in, which I think is an important practice for any sort of politics. That should be something that everybody would support. They asked the university to stop punishing pro-Palestinian speech, which is something that was a problem not only after October 7th, but also beforehand. The way that our, you know, student organizations, the Students for Justice in Palestine, were often being targeted for disciplinary action on campus, even when they were doing the same things that other student organizations were. So, you know, all of that, I think, it continues to be in process. Is that what you would say, Will, for what's going on?
Yeah, no, you put it very well.
So, and yeah. I would like you, Will, to comment a little bit more on the atmosphere or the general environment at George Washington University, since Libby mentioned that in her response to the previous question. Like, you know, I know that different universities had different approaches, different degrees of interference, or, you know, a hands-off approach when it comes to dealing with the protests and the protesters. If you can just elaborate a little bit more on what you believe to be the, you know, the situation, the atmosphere, the environment that prevailed at George Washington University, and what were some of the pros and cons of the way in which the administration dealt with these protests?
You know, I would actually have to say that before the camp started, going back to October 2023, that there was a general sort of disposition of the university to not talk about Israel and Palestine. And there was a real discouragement for faculty to do events, and there were so many times where there was just kind of like so much controversy put into place just at the idea of doing events. So, you know, the administration ran away from being a leader or sort of like modeling how to discuss politics. A lot of it was happening then in classrooms, where students were very responsible for the most part and able to sort of talk things through in an informed way. But at the university level, there was just so much sort of pressure against doing anything on this issue. And so it really set up, I think, in many ways, this overreaction and hostility to the beginning of the protest camps. And as Libby pointed out, there had already been these efforts to silence student activism previously. So the university administration was really not in a good position, starting position, when these camps went off. And they took more of a suppression approach rather than a negotiation and dialogue approach. You know, I think that other universities were much smarter in the way they handled it, but each university is different. I wouldn't say that there were many pros in how the university responded. I mean, they were kind of lucky that the Metro Police Department said that we're not going to go in and close up the camp immediately, because what actually happened at the camp was almost in many ways a model for what a university can be, where students were initiating education on their own. They were organizing teach-ins. There was much sort of like opening of speech, and there was a sense of community, and people who disagreed still went to the camp and they argued with people. I mean, sometimes, yeah, it got a little heated, but for the most part, it was like a very open place to discuss things. So I think the university could have handled it much better instead of answering with police, because it's ultimately a nonviolent protest, mm-hmm. and police use violence, and this is not what the university should be doing.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Will. And I come back to you with a question, Libby, which is related as well. You mentioned something about the word international pressure, and I want you to elaborate a little bit more on what that means. And also, following up on this particular point, obviously, there have been right and wrong approaches in terms of dealing with these protests on the part of university administrations. We have seen what happened in Colombia, for example, which ignited the protests for the large part. So I want you to elaborate on these two points. Number one, what does it mean, the international pressure when it comes to GW in particular? And number two, the right and wrong approaches in dealing with the protests from your own point of view.
Great. You know, the it was international pressure in the sense that Washington, D.C. is the capital of the country. And so it's often being shown everywhere as a model. And it was being used to, you know, as a criticism, especially for people who were criticizing the student protests internationally. You know, even Washington, D.C. can't control, you know, student protests, which was also then, you know, part of what our students were advocating for. There were two things that were quite unique about the GW encampment. One is that it was four blocks from the White House. So it is literally students coming right at the center of power. There are two blocks from the State Department on one side, four blocks from the White House. You know, they understand part of what they're doing every time they're practicing political speech and political action. They're oriented to our university, but they're also oriented to the nation itself. And the second thing that was unique is that it wasn't only an encampment from one university. Part of what they were trying to do was to show solidarity across the larger Washington, D.C. area. So you had up to 8 colleges with students who were involved with faculty observers and buffers. And so part of what they were trying to do was to make an argument that their encampment was also significantly larger, even though they are targeting their individual universities, that part of what they're calling for is something much larger than even divestment from the university, but was changing the entire national narrative about the U.S.'s support for Israel in its, you know, in its war, in its genocidal intentions in Gaza. And so that ended up shifting a little bit how the university responded and also how the students were always, you know, positioning themselves vis-a-vis discussions about the nation.
Right. And the right and wrong approaches in dealing with the protests, from your own opinion, maybe an example of, you know, bad approach beside the Colombia, you know, starking example, of course, and maybe an example of a good approach where the administration and a certain university was able to respond in the proper and correct way in dealing with the protests.
Right. You know, there were bad responses in many places. Colombia is obviously an example, but we also saw at a lot of places that were not in huge metropolitan centers, but places in smaller college towns where the police would be immediately called in. I'm thinking of Dartmouth, I'm thinking of Indiana University, Ohio State, where police are not used to being in a position to support First Amendment rights to free expression and to free assembly. And so the immediate response by presidents and also by local police was to come in and to beat and arrest and criminalize students for literally camping on the grounds of the universities that they attend. So those were the terrible responses, and we saw a lot of them, right? The push to criminalize nonviolent speech in really brutal ways.
I just want to add about UCLA, because what we saw there was so horrendous. Basically, one evening, a bunch of pro-Israeli protesters went and attacked physically the encampment while the LAPD sat by and watched them do that. And then the next day, the LAPD used that attack as a pretense to go and take down the encampment with the university's blessing. And to me, that's one of the most egregious places. I mean, on top of UT Austin, where the governor went ballistic and basically sent in the troopers to squelch dissent there. So these are some of the most horrible. But I know, Libby, you can talk about some positive, more positive cases too, so that we're not all pessimistic.
Before we move to the positive, let me just highlight the fact that it's not only about students. We have seen some faculty members being beaten up and dragged and arrested in front of the cameras. You know, I was like, oh my God, like, you know, I remember the professor screaming, you know, I'm the chair of the, you know, Department of Philosophy at one university, another professor being, taken down by the police, and she's arrested and also screaming, I'm a professor, I'm a professor. So it seems like it's not only about students, there has been also some repression of faculty as well. Maybe Libby, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw that at a lot of places. Certainly, like, you know, Will and I's position at GW, not only was not unique that there were many faculty doing a lot of the work that we were doing, but there are faculty all around the country who understood their work to be protecting the students, observing, making sure that things were, you know, were that the students were being treated fairly in the process. And so oftentimes those are the faculty who were getting caught up. You know, faculty who were getting beaten up because they were near the protest, faculty who wouldn't step down when the police were coming and saying, we're arresting you. And the faculty are like, you have no right to do this. And then they were arrested anyways. In some cases, it was just faculty walking across campus. And right, in the case of the philosophy professor at Emory, if I remember correctly, right, it was a faculty member just seeing a police officer beating up a student, saying that this was wrong. And then she ends up getting arrested herself just for the comment of criticizing the kind of violence that she was seeing. So we did see a lot of that as well, right? There was no real differentiation once the police were on the scene of who was getting arrested, who wasn't, how people were being treated, right? It was everybody was being considered a violent enemy that had to be, put down in some way, right? You know, that they had to be stopped. But we did see some more positive things.
Yeah.
Right. The positive things, I think, you know, we saw, for instance, at Northwestern, at Wesleyan, I'm sure there's many other schools, Brown University to a certain degree, right? Where on the one hand, presidents did not immediately see the students who were protesting as enemies, but remembered that they were actually like parts of a community, that they had legitimate and serious political concerns about the world, about Gaza, and also about how their universities were profiting off of what was happening in Gaza and supporting it. And then they would engage their students in respectful dialogue. Mm-hmm. Some of them would meet some of the, you know, of the things that the negotiators were hoping to achieve, some with more success and some with less success. Yeah. But the best result was when you actually saw administrators treating students respectfully, recognizing the political importance of their encampments and treating it as such, as instances of really valuable political speech, and taking their negotiations seriously, right? With any form of civil disobedience, people don't engage in civil disobedience if they feel that their institutions are listening to them. Because otherwise you go, you talk to people, the institutions are responsive to your needs, and they're dealt with and you move on, right? People only do these kind of acts of encampment or civil disobedience protest in this way when institutions are refusing to listen to them. And that's what we saw with the students. So the best responses were those that began listening to students, which really helped to de-escalate and to meet the needs of the people protesting in some way.
So respect, listening, and dialogue are very important key to success of this movement and any type of protest or any kind of demands and movements. We'll come back to this very important discussion right after this commercial break. Stay tuned, please.
In a perfect world, everyone would be a perfect driver.
Hands at 9 and 3, everyone.
9 and 3.
Everyone would follow all the rules.
Please, go ahead and merge. I'll make room.
Thank you, fellow driver.
And nothing unexpected would ever happen. Even the squirrels would know the right time to safely cross the road. In this perfect world, you wouldn't have to wear a seatbelt. But in case you hadn't noticed, we don't live in a perfect world. About 1,000 people in Michigan die each year in vehicle crashes, and thousands more are injured. Wearing your seatbelt reduces your risk of death in a crash by 45% in a car and by 60% in a pickup truck. So until we find a perfect world to drive in, make our imperfect world safer by buckling up. A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.
Are you going to start a restaurant or a grocery store soon? Do you need floor plans and designs? Call Najee Abood at 734-744-9796. Do you want to buy kitchen and restaurant equipment at discount prices? Call Najee Abood now, 734-744-9796. New Concept Products and Design, the trademark of kitchen equipment. 5% discount on all purchases of $75,000 or more. New Concept Products and Design, new location, 31185 Schoolcraft in Livonia. Learn more at www.newconceptproducts.com. Call Najee Abood, 734-744-9796.
With more than 30,000 successful in vitro fertilizations, IVF Michigan is now ranked as one of America's best fertility clinics, according to Newsweek magazine. IVF Michigan fertility centers are the recognized leaders in high-quality fertility care. With locations in Bloomfield Hills and 9 other cities in Michigan and Ohio, IVF has experts in all aspects of the field. A founding member, American Board Certified Dr. Nicholas Shama, is one of the leading reproductive endocrinologists in Michigan and Ohio. He has performed over 20,000 successful IVF cases, and it's helped thousands of couples fulfill their dreams of parenthood. when it's time to get personalized care from Dr. Nicholas Shama at one of America's best fertility clinics. Call IVF Michigan Fertility Centers in Michigan and Ohio toll-free at 855-952-9600. 855-952-9600.
This is Dr. Sahar Kamis. Welcome to my program, The Bridge. A monthly show bridging different cultures, communities, and faith traditions. Watch The Bridge on America's Voice of the Arab Network on all social media platforms.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamis, and we're talking today about a very important and timely topic, the American Student Spring, the significance and implications. And with me this morning discussing this important topic are Professor Elizabeth Anker, who is a professor of American Studies at George Washington University, and Associate Professor William Humans, who is an Associate Professor of Media Studies and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Will, the term Arab Spring, right, is a term that has been used frequently to describe the movements in the Arab region, and many people have written about it, including myself and yourself. Now, when this term is being used in the context of the students' spring in the United States, what is your take on that? Are you pro this term? Do you like it? You don't like it? What is your feeling about it and why?
You know, given what has happened to all the countries where there were Arab springs, I would... hate to see a sort of analogy with the student spring. I mean, you know, that's being a little tongue in cheek, because I think the idea is that people who are relatively repressed, I mean, of course, the Arab citizens in Tunisia, Egypt, and so forth were really directly repressed, whereas the students acting out are acting out of solidarity, but have faced their own kind of repression. And that's a repression that comes from silencing of speech on this very issue. And in a way, they're throwing off those systems that police what can be said, what can be talked about. And so I see some parallels there, and that the idea of a spring bringing forward the possibility of a new future. So the students are acting in a way that, you know, is breaking with taboos, is going to lead to a new normal, new expectations. And the power of these students, by the way, is that they haven't internalized the limitations in the way that older generations do. You know, we come to think of like what's possible politically, but students come in with a fresh eyes, fresh imagination. They see something wrong and they think that they must act, where a lot of older generations through wisdom become a bit more defeatist. And I think that that's where there's a parallel, that there, it feels like it's a new day. Mm-hmm. But what worries me is actually what we learn from the Arab Spring, which is our regimes find ways to undo change. and so I do worry about what's going to be coming in the fall. It's not just university administrations that are deeply averse to progress and change. It's also that there's these boards of trustees that control these institutions. We just saw the president, I think, at Sacramento State University, who made a deal with the protesters, got fired. And then also there's the donors and the external advocacy groups that are pushing this issue on campus. They're going to be very mobilized around this. And state legislatures on top of it, who are looking at ways to criminalize dissent towards Israel. They've already passed anti-BDS laws in, I think, about half the states. So we're going to see these engines of repression get fired up in the fall even more.
Libby, as also a political theorist and someone who's been talking about, you know, issues of freedoms, obviously, I want you to talk a little bit about the boundaries of academic freedom, freedom of expression in general, academic freedom in particular. What are the boundaries within which these students can express their views and their opinions and go out and protest? And are there any red lines, you know, that they have to stop at? And if so, what are these red lines? And if you can give us some examples, please.
Sure. Freedom of expression is really broad in the U.S. And even though, you know, sometimes there are places where it does and does not apply as much, I think in a university context, especially in a context where academic freedom, which is the freedom to research, pursue, and advocate for things that comes about through your own scholarship, your own understanding of politics, right? Freedom of expression is really high in this instance. And of course, you know, the boundaries are usually drawn when people are advocating clearly for violence and trying to instigate violence. So that's a somewhat high bar. And if the point of universities in many ways is to cultivate academic freedom and free expression, right? It's the pursuit of knowledge, the pursuit of research, the pursuit of understanding the world, right? That bar is really high for what students can say and how they can say it. You know, if the line is advocating for violence, that is something we barely saw at any of these protests, certainly not at GW, right? And calling to end a war, calling for freedom of people is certainly not advocating violence or supporting it in any way. So a lot of where the lines were drawn around what students can and cannot say, we're drawing them way too tightly. Because, in truth, the students do have a lot of capacity, both under academic freedom and under freedom of expression. And none of them were doing what they were being accused of, right? Criticizing Zionism and calling for an end to war is not advocating and inciting violence in any way. And I think oftentimes it was intentionally misunderstood to use as justification for shutting down the protests.
I mean, I was particularly stunned when I saw the moment of Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, being questioned in Congress about using the phrase from the river to the sea. And we're talking about a congresswoman, right? And the phrase was seen as like, oh, this is calling for the end of Israel, and therefore it is anti-Semitic, and therefore it is calling for the killing or the genocide of all Jews. I mean, it's very important to have clarity in terms of what these words mean, what these phrases mean. I mean, Libby, and then I'll also hear from Will as well. How can we possibly reach a level of certain clarity in terms of rhetoric and language and definitions in order to protect free speech in a more practical way? What are your thoughts, Libby?
I think it's hard, and I think it's always important to listen to how people are understanding what they're advocating for, mm-hmm. right? A lot of the way in which the language from the river to the sea, what it means, has changed significantly from when it was first created early on. And when you almost universally ask students, what do you mean by saying? They're understanding it as a call for freedom, that everybody between the river and the sea should be free. And the people who aren't free at this moment in that space are Palestinians. Calling for Palestinian freedom is calling for a free land. It's calling for liberation, right? Liberation for everybody. And so listening and trusting the students, listening to how they understand the language that they're using is really important. And I think the students were so often, as Will earlier noted, were never allowed to have the authority of their own sayings, and they were always being, intentionally misunderstood from the media or whatever. Anything that they were saying, it was being hyperbolically explained as a call for violence, whatever they were saying. And I also think it's really important to understand that the protests are still happening within the context of a university where students are learning. And so oftentimes, when people were saying things that maybe other people might not be, comfortable with, sort of claims about, a kind of a decolonization that would be exterminationist of Israelis, and saying chants that were like that. And then other students would say, well, when you say that, well, maybe you're just, perpetuating another form of exterminationist logic. Let's actually think about it as calling for interdependence. And students would say, oh, okay, thank you for, I didn't know that. Let me, rethink these things. And allowing, students see what's in front of them right now. They see the horrific violence and genocide in Gaza. They want to change it, and they're trying to advocate for a voice. And that's what's bringing all the students down there. And then the space itself becomes a lesson in how do we use language? What does it mean? Right. How do we make it learn something differently? And we need to allow these 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds to be educated at the same time while they're on the ground, and to learn from each other. And, think expecting that level of compassion and generosity to them will also allow us to interpret what they're doing in a different light.
Exactly. Like turning it into an educational moment, right? A moment to learn something new, a moment to learn something valuable and important. And Will, I also want to hear from you, because this is a very important point. How can we make this an educational, informative moment where students can really feel like they own their narrative, they're exercising the right for free speech and academic freedom? And also, as Libby said, being aware of the boundaries and limitations, obviously not calling for violence and all of that. What are some of the tips and clues that maybe we should bear in mind when we're talking about all of these issues?
Well, I would add that, Libby and I are very much champions of the ideal of the university. And that's, I think, drives a lot of our analysis. And when we make demands on the university administration, it comes from this place of here's what the university should be. But these students are getting a first-rate education in, you know, institutions and what the university actually is. And they are getting a very realistic portrait of how power operates in these institutions, especially vis-a-vis the politics of the larger world. And I think that that's actually a kind of an invaluable experience. I just hope it doesn't defeat them in any way, and that they become such realists that they sort of internalize the sort of pessimism of that. So, you know, I think when I think back to my student activism, I would say I learned as much from being a student activist as I did from my classrooms. And I actually encourage students to become engaged in politics, to become student activists, just for that reason alone, just because it teaches them how to advocate, how to argue, how to become fluent in institutions and how to navigate them. But I think that the education is going to happen no matter how the university reacts, whether it reacts in a way that it should, and embodying a sort of vision of the university that is a defensible one. But unfortunately, a lot of them are much more like corporations, private entities that are beholden to interests outside of just merely the educational ones. And I think that's really being exposed by these reactions that we're seeing across the country.
Excellent. We'll come back to this very important discussion right after this commercial break. Stay tuned, please.
What's my ETA?
Your estimated time of arrival is 9:17.
I'm late. I'll have to punch it.
Speeding will save you just 1 minute and 36 seconds. It will also increase your risk of a crash, as well as the odds that you will be stopped and issued an expensive speeding ticket.
Yeah, but...
In 1 year, there were 22,000 speeding-related crashes in Michigan, resulting in 200 deaths.
If I had someone in the car with me, I'd drive slower. But it's just me.
This is not a logical response. Though you have no passenger, surrounding cars contain 27 others, including 5 children and 1 Labrador Retriever.
How do you know all this stuff?
I know everything, Kevin.
Your risk of a crash increases with every mile you drive over the speed limit. So slow down. Speed enforcement is happening now. A message from the Michigan Office of Highway Safety Planning.
At Top Rehab Physical Therapy Clinic in Dearborn, we provide effective physical therapy sessions in order to limit pain and discomfort. Top Rehab provides physical therapy care for any diagnosis prescribed by a physician, and we regularly see and treat conditions such as stroke, TMJ, fibromyalgia, sciatica, joint pain, and more. We use a variety of pain management methods, including modalities, soft tissue mobilization, and therapeutic exercise. If you're in need of physical rehabilitation or physical therapy, get the highest quality health care at Top Rehab. Most insurance is accepted, and we're open Monday, Wednesday, and Friday 8 to 6, Tuesday and Thursday 8 to 5, and Saturday 10 till 2. Call for an appointment today at 313-846-0555. That's 313-846-0555. Choose Top Rehab Physical Therapy Clinic on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn. Life's too short to be in pain.
Ziad brand. Quality products from our family to yours. Ziad Brothers Importing offers the finest quality products, including brands like Sultan, Kraft, Nestle, Hook, Rico Picon, Donna, and many more. Ask your retailer to carry these fine products because you deserve the very best. For more information, visit our website at www.ziad.com. That's www.ziad.com. Ziad, quality products from our family to yours.
This is Dr. Sahar Kamis. Welcome to my program, The Bridge. A monthly show bridging different cultures, communities, and faith traditions. Watch The Bridge on America's Voice of the Arab Network on all social media platforms.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. This is your host, Dr. Sahar Kamis, and we're talking today about the timely and important students' protests on U.S. campuses, their historical significance, and their long-term implications. And with me this morning discussing this important and timely topic are Dr. Elizabeth Anker, Professor of American Studies at George Washington University, and Associate Professor William Humans, Associate Professor of Media Studies and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Libby, there have been so many strategies that have been used, unfortunately, to tarnish the image of the protesters, to paint them in a negative light, to try to distort, if you will, their image and really portray them in a negative light in the media and in the public eye. Can you please comment on these particular strategies?
You know, some of them are new and some of them are old. You know, a common strategy that I think has been used since the 60s, if not before, to tarnish student protesters is to say that they are too young to know what they're talking about, right? That they're naive, that they don't have the intellectual chops, that they're so idealistic, that they don't understand history, they don't understand complexity, right? Painting them as if they are not actually the moral conscience of the nation, which they almost always are, right? You can almost track progress by where student protests are, you know, but instead to denigrate them as not intelligent, as not thoughtful, as not educated. So we are seeing a huge amount of this, right? We see people often saying students don't understand the region. They don't understand its complexity, right? We heard, Hillary Clinton saying this recently, but we otherwise hear it all the time. You know, that students are problematic because they just are, contagiously seeing what other people are doing, or that it's cool to protest is also a way of denigrating it, rather than thinking about what actually makes being part of the encampment so captivating for students. And in part, it's because they actually feel that they're part of something that is politically powerful, valuable, and morally clear to them in a way that other parts of their, education might not be, right? So taking the things that bring them together and then denigrating them for that. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of people claiming they don't understand the region, or that they couldn't find Gaza on a map, regardless of whether that's true, but using that to say that they then, therefore, their speech is illegitimate, that they can never talk about something unless they can precisely locate something at any moment, as if that itself is its own moral compass. So we've seen, a lot of traditional ways, but also new, particular to this moment, for how students are being attacked as not being, not allowing their speech to be valuable, not allowing it to stand on its own, and not presuming that they have real, good faith in what they're doing and why they're doing it.
And if I may also ask you, before I go to Will with the same question about the tarnishing of the images of the protesters and the negative, claims and misperceptions against them, I also want to ask you, Libby, about your own prediction about the trajectory and the future of these protests. Now that we are coming close to the end of the academic year, obviously, and everybody is going to be going home. Some students are going to be going home to other maybe states, other places. How do you actually perceive the future trajectory of these protests moving forward?
I think it is unclear, to be honest. I think there's going to be a lot of reckoning among colleges over the summer for how they responded, the damage that it took to a lot of their reputations for the way in which they treated students, and what they want to do moving forward, how they might want to negotiate when we come back. My guess is the summer itself will be a downtime. A lot of students themselves don't live near their colleges. They're home for the summer. But the students themselves are going to have time. Some of them only had a couple weeks or a week to prepare, even less, I believe, for some of these protests that they were enacting. So they're actually going to have some more time to think things through, to think about what worked, what didn't, how they can push more strongly for their negotiations. I think it's possible, that things are going to start right up again the minute we come back to school, both sides probably fortified in some way. I don't think that this issue will drop. I think we just might see things developing, a little, perhaps less energetically, but perhaps in a more organized and powerful way.
So you see the summer as a time for them to recharge and rethink and, maybe reconsider some of the things they have done right, some of the things they need to improve moving forward, but you don't see it like an end to this movement.
I don't. And especially because, on the one hand, the students will and administrations will be regrouping. On the other hand, what's unfolding in Gaza is a catastrophe where every minute makes a difference in whose lives can be saved. How can we stop, prevent some of the destruction? So I also think that, against a time to recharge, they also have a real moral impetus to try to get the war to stop as much as possible and to use their levers of power. So that is something that is motivating the students, perhaps not the administration, but I think is going to be a real forward push and momentum for them.
Excellent. Thank you for this positive outlook on the future. And Will, I'll come to you with the same questions. First, about the tarnishing of the image of the protesters, maybe not only what, Libby mentioned in terms of, showing them or trying to show them as incompetent or incapable or, ill-informed, they don't know what's going on, but also there have been charges of violence, of chaos, of outside instigators, of anti-Semitism. If you can, in a nutshell, try to provide us with some kind of background about these particular charges, and also how can we respond to them?
There's also been an effort to taint the protesters as being anti-Semitic, there's been outside groups that have tried to provoke certain kinds of reactions, or they'll try to identify signs or slogans and say that those are the same things as anti-Jewish hatred. And sometimes these get picked up by media, and then they use it as a way to sort of depict all the protesters being as such. But the student protesters, especially at GW, were very disciplined. And when they saw a message or heard a slogan that they thought was reflecting any kind of hateful intent, they tried to silence it. It was very difficult for them to do that because a lot of times it was people who were not affiliated with the camp who were coming in with signs or slogans or that kinds of things. And so that's one of the tips that the students can deploy is that they have to sort of monitor the messages that are coming out from the people who are there to support them. And that doesn't get picked up in media as much. It's more sensational to find a protest chant or a sign and to use that rather than it is to get into the nitty-gritty of actual organizing.
What about the claim that some people have been trying to spread that there have been some outside instigators, not just organizing the protests, but actually creating some kind of chaos and violence among the protesters? Is this true? Have you seen any incidents where this actually happened?
There was actually a really good study that was published in The Guardian that there was a quantitative analysis of all the encampments and actually other protests as well. I think they had like maybe 1,000 cases total they looked at. They only found violence in 3% of all these protests in the United States. And of that 3%, almost all the violence was initiated by police. And so the idea that there's significant violence, is really not empirically founded. So a lot of times the media coverage, when it wants to show violence, it really shows stuff like property destruction. Oh, the protesters at Columbia broke a window to occupy the building. Or at GW, they kept talking about the statue of George Washington being defaced because, someone spray painted something on it, which is very easy to clean. So it tends to focus, the violence of these protests tends to focus a lot more on property damage. But we've seen real violence directed against protesters, not just by police, but by counter protesters, including, at Columbia, there was an incident where pro-Israeli protesters used a chemical agent, a spray against students and sent several to the hospital, but that wasn't picked up at all by the media. And so it's a complete misrepresentation because of who's actually carrying out violence at these protests. It's not by the Palestine Solidarity activists.
Right. And, I want to also end with the very same question I asked Libby earlier, which is about your own prediction of the future trajectory of these protests. How do you see it going from here and how do you see it evolving in the future?
Right. I think a lot of it depends on what happens in terms of Gaza. I don't see an end to that in the near future. So I think that the same thing that motivated the students in the spring will probably still be there in the fall. But one thing I do want to just caution against is that when it comes to campus activism, it is very sort of seasonal. It comes and it goes, it ebbs and it flows. So even if there's a downturn in student activism in the fall, that doesn't mean that it's going away. And that's just the history of student activism. So I'm actually optimistic about the midterm future, not necessarily the short-term future. Because you have to remember that in November, there's going to be an election. Trump's probably going to win again. It's going to create a whole new focus for a lot of student activists and dominate the discussion on campus. So we might not see in the fall that Gaza and Palestine are the focus point any longer, but that doesn't mean that this movement's going away by any stretch.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I really appreciate the input from my two valuable guests today. I want to thank my two guests today, Professor Elizabeth Anker, Professor of American Studies at George Washington University, and Dr. William Humans, Associate Professor of Media Studies and Public Affairs at George Washington University. Thank you so much for the valuable insight and input today.
Thank you.
And thanks so much to all our listeners and viewers everywhere. Take care and goodbye.